everywhere the glint of gold. That was what the famed archaeologist Howard Carter said when he first caught a glimpse of the treasures of the pharaoh Tutankhamun on a late November day in 1922, when he inserted a candle through a small hole in the sealed entry door to the pharaoh's tomb in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. Everywhere the glint of gold. A truly magical moment for Carter on what he called the Day of Days, the most wonderful he had ever lived through. But we had a chance to see and feel echoes of that wonderment this past Saturday night, when Egypt presented an awesome spectacle of kings and queens that provided glimpses of the magic and mystery of the ancient pharaonic world, just as this Kimitrosina was beginning to come into place. We'll have a look at the timing and symbolism associated with this after I welcome you to episode 28 of Navigating the Energies of Life, a podcast that looks at how the energies of the Maya calendar are at work in the world and how they apply to daily lives. We're working at this time with the Kimitrosina, oriented around the idea of death and regeneration, one of the 20 13-day periods that work together to form the Maya 260-day count of days that is the core of their calendrical system. As always, each of the days in this count is unique in terms of its characteristic energies, and each of the Trisinas has its own unique theme. The one that we're working on right now, the Kimitrosina, places the focus on death, the return to spiritual foundations that provide the source point for the regeneration of life. I was working on the horoscope blog for this Trisina that I posted that evening when I saw what was about to happen in Egypt and was astonished, in a sort of, well, of course, kind of way, when I realized what was to be the timing for this event. It was to start at sundown, just as the Ben Trisina associated with personal authority was transforming into the Kimitrosina, pertaining to death and regeneration. And it was all about transferring the mummies of 22 ancient rulers of Egypt from their last place of residence in the Old Egyptian Museum in Cairo to the brand new Grand Museum 3 miles away. And it was to be done in grand style, with music, dance, and a cast of thousands evocative of the ancient funeral ceremonies that would have accompanied the entombment of a pharaoh. I didn't quite know what to expect, but it felt like something exciting was about to happen, and it certainly exceeded my general expectations, except for the fact that it was hard to find an English translation on live stream, and I would have preferred to see much slower camera work in terms of the performances and the procession itself, but overall it was amazing and would have been unforgettable for anyone fortunate enough to have been there. For the participants, it would have been a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. On this lovely evening in Cairo, on the night of 13 Chikchan, transformational life force, at the end of the Ben Trisina, which was the personal authority Trisina, there was glorious music choreographed from different locations, from a full, wondrous orchestra inside the new Grand Museum, to drummers and musicians stationed at various locations along the parade route. There were dancers and singers going all out to present magical performances, some from gorgeous locations that highlighted ancient archaeological wonders like the Great Pyramids and Hatshepsut's temple, and even some performed in niches along the parade route. There were replicas of ancient chariots drawn by horses. There were performers dressed like priests and handmaidens. And there were 22 gold-bedecked vehicles decorated with pharaonic motifs, each of which carried gold-adorned coffin boxes, which contained the mummy of a king or queen. Inscribed on the sides of each was the name of the king or queen it was carrying, inscribed in three languages. As the mummies arrived at their new location, they were welcomed with a 21-gun artillery salute. As I was watching all this, I was thinking, what a way to transition into the Kimi Tresina, a grand festival to honor ancient leaders for whom the idea of immortality was extremely important. With the mummies of those rulers actually in attendance, some 3,000 or more years after they walked this earth. It was amazing to think that this was happening at all, but that it was happening just as the Maya day lord known as One Kimi, Lord One Death, was in the process of coming in was, well, mind-boggling. But absolutely right on schedule, even tying in with Easter, which is also associated with death and regeneration or resurrection, which happens as well to be a very, very key part of ancient Maya mythology as well. So this is like a fusion of traditions and ideas from several cultural traditions all coming together at once. There are others noted in my blog that also tie in with all of this. As usual, of course, I've highlighted the days of this Tresina in my horoscope blog, and I will be referring to some of that within this podcast. But because of the uniqueness of this event in Egypt and the wonderful way it tied in with these current energies, I'm going to look first at a few more key things related to this once-in-a-lifetime occasion. And since this is the death and resurrection Tresina, I want to go back in time a bit. I think that Lord One Kimi would approve of me providing a bit of background. First of all, who were these ancient kings and queens, and how did they get to this place and time? Well, let's have a look. Some of those in this group were some of the greatest in the history of Egypt, such as Amenhotep I, the founder of the 18th dynasty, who ruled 3,500 years ago. Some were related to each other, such as Amos Nefertari, who was the mother of Amenhotep I. Some succeeded each other as pharaohs, such as Thutmose I and Thutmose II, who was married to Hatshepsut, and Thutmose III. Hatshepsut was particularly notable since she was actually crowned as a king of Egypt, not as a queen. As a king of Egypt, she could rule in her own right. And to ensure this, she was depicted at times in the garb of a man. Very unconventional. Hatshepsut's temple near Dar al-Bahri is one of the wonders of ancient Egypt. And there were even some dances done in front of that temple on Saturday night, which is really beautiful to see. The highly influential Queen Tiye is also in this group. She was the mother of Akhenaten and the grandmother of Tutankhamun. And then there were the great builders, such as Amenhotep III, Seti I, and Ramses II, all responsible for some of the most awesome building projects in the ancient world. Ramses ruled Egypt for 67 years. And as a further sense of perspective, apparently there's a depiction of Ramses II on a temple wall at Abydos showing him and his father, Seti I, making offerings to 76 of his predecessors. So this is deep, deep history. These then were some of the pharaohs: Ramses, Seti I, Seti II, and so many others whose remains were all part of that procession on Saturday evening. Quite mind-boggling to think about. How they came to be in the old museum is a long story. But Howard Carter provides a report that includes the testimony of one of the grave robbers of a former royal tomb. This testimony speaks of what they did with regard to one group. So this is from that testimony. Quote, "We opened their coffins and their coverings in which they were. We found the august mummy of this king. There was a numerous list of amulets and ornaments of gold at its throat. Its head had a mask of gold upon it. The august mummy of this king was overlaid with gold throughout. Its coverings were wrought with gold and silver, within and without, inlaid with every costly stone. We stripped off the gold, which we found on the august mummy of this god, and its amulets and ornaments, which were at its throat, and the coverings wherein it rested. We found the king's wife. Likewise, we stripped off all that we found on her. Likewise, we set fire to their coverings. We stole their furniture, which we found with them, being vases of gold, silver, and bronze. We divided and made the gold which we found on these two gods, on their mummies, and the amulets, ornaments, and coverings into 8 parts. Howard Carter speaks of a cache of 13 mummies. In his words, quote, "No fewer than 13 of the royal mummies found their way at one time or another to the tomb of Amenhotep II. And here they were allowed to remain. The other kings were eventually collected from their various hiding places, taken out of the valley altogether, and placed in a well-hidden tomb cut in the Dar el-Bahri cliff. This was the final move for, by some accident, the exact locality of the tomb was lost, and the mummies remained in peace for nearly 3,000 years. Apparently, most of the 22 kings and queens who were being honored at this time were discovered in two archaeological caches in Luxor in the late 1800s, and they have been relocated several times by archaeologists over the past 100 years or so. With this in mind, let's have a look at some of the symbols that were incorporated into this grand parade. I think that some of the most striking are those associated with the ancient Egyptian goddess known as Maat, who embodied seven core principles of life: truth, balance, order, harmony, righteousness, morality, and justice. She was also associated with wisdom, the law, and the regulation of the seasons and the cosmos. In ancient Egypt, it was expected that the priests, pharaohs, and their families embody these principles as examples for the rest of society. A lovely website called Isium Sanctuary highlights these seven principles, and I'll add a link to this in the podcast post. But let's have a quick look at these and think as well about their implications for today's world. The first is truth. The ability to understand the difference between the real and the unreal, something that has become one of our contemporary world's dominant issues. But the central idea here is that reality is grounded in the belief of the greatest goodness, that which permeates all that exists, that all living creatures are sacred, and all are spiritual beings deserving of respect and honor. The second is justice, the state in which there is equity for all persons, for all creatures, and for our planet itself, on which we rely for life itself. Equity means that all have equal opportunity for basic needs to be met: food, shelter, water, safety, medical care, dignity, respect, community, to live in peace, to fully and meaningfully participate and contribute to society, to offer gifts, talents, and/or essence towards the good of the whole. The third is harmony, the state of being in which different expressions of Mother Nature, including air, water, earth, deities who represent natural forces, humans, animals, plants, all work together in ways that create alignment and beauty. The emphasis is on expressions of true authenticity, not clones according to someone else's often negative programming, but harmony through naturally occurring authenticity, the kind that is possible when each entity is being true to its deeper reality, true to its source. Another of these is balance, a state in which the internal and external environments of an individual or group are aligned with this goddess and all she represents, and with Mother Nature, one another, and the rest of creation. Cosmic balance. It is the experience of existing in the place where opposites meet, which becomes a creation point where new life is generated and new possibilities can come into being. A fifth is order, a state of being in which things are arranged in ways that are uncluttered, free of excess and clear. A sixth is reciprocity, the idea that what comes around goes around. There is a motion, a rhythm of cause and effect, give and take, forward and backward to every aspect of creation. And the seventh is propriety or morality. This pertains to what it means to be and to do what is right, according to the truth that all living creatures are spiritual beings and deserve to exist. This means to do no harm to another being, creature, or aspect of the goddess, beginning with self. So these were all teachings about how to live in ways that were beneficial for both individuals and for society at large. They were ideals. We won't get into issues associated with the ancient world, such as slavery and wars, not at this point anyway. But these ideals, representing a belief in the possibility of a just and ordered society, were commendable. In ancient Egyptian mythology, it was believed that the sun god Ra, the giver of life and the prime representative of cosmic order and equilibrium, set his daughter Maat in place to counter something called Isfet, associated with chaos, violence, injustice, and other such evils. With this in mind, it was part of the duties of kings to ensure that Maat remained in place. The great pharaoh, Akhenaten, Tutankhamun's father, was seen as being particularly emphatic about this idea, but unfortunately, many of his contemporaries were not happy about that, perhaps because it was so hard to live up to, but that's a whole other story. Something that likely parallels the issues that we're facing in modern societies. But if we lived in a world where the principles of Maat were given the same priority as they were back when such ideals were first developed, our world would be much, much more livable than it is today. Even the creation of a set of ideals like this thousands of years ago says a great deal. Principles to live by. Back to the parade and the symbols of the goddess Maat. Her presence was symbolized by large outstretched wings, the kind of wings that are shown in the logo associated with the pharaoh's parade, gold wings against a blue background, and the kind of wings that were outstretched on the sides of each of the 22 vehicles transporting the mummies to their new home. It's as if the goddess Maat, daughter of Ra and connected with Thoth, the god of wisdom, was escorting and protecting each and every one of them. Lining the long processional roadway that the drummers, priests, maidens, chariots, and mummy-bearing vehicles traveled along were tall sculptures, looking a bit like banners, about 10 to 12 feet tall, representing ostrich feathers, the kind of feather that Maat would wear in her hair to represent truth. The ostrich feather, known as Shut, was a symbol of the god Shu, whose name means he who rises up, an luminous space. He was an Egyptian god of the air and the father of the earth and the sky, one of the primordial ancient Egyptian gods and one of the nine deities of the Ennead of the Heliopolis. He was seen as the god of peace, air, and wind, and even associated with lions. often shown wearing an ostrich feather in his hair. Since he personified the air, he was seen as being a cooling and calming influence associated with peace and everything associated with Mott. An ostrich feather, which is very soft and wispy, was seen as a metaphor for these ideas. The feather of Mott, in particular, is a tall ostrich plume with the tip bent over under its own weight, exactly as shown in those banner-like sculptures lining that avenue. Apparently, the ostrich feather was seen to be the only bird feather that is of equal width on both sides of its central axis and, therefore, symbolizes equity and balance. In any case, this is the feather and the goddess associated with the ancient Egyptian ceremony of the weighing of the heart, as shown in many ancient paintings and tomb carvings. The feather was shown in scenes of the hall of Mott, the hall where the deceased was judged for his or her worthiness to enter the afterlife. The deceased's first task upon entry into the Hall of Mott was to correctly address each of the 42 judges or assessors in the hall by name. These were the judges who oversaw the weighing of the heart, and each was pictured holding an ostrich feather. The judges seem to be connected with the list of confessions found in the papyrus of Ani, called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, that is seen as the world's oldest moral and ethical code for human conduct, created over 3,000 years ago. It lists confessions such as, I have not uttered curses. I have made none to weep. I have wronged none. This process of confessing allowed the deceased to demonstrate that they were not only knowledgeable of the gods and of ethical laws, but by reciting the list of sins that they did not commit during their lifetime, basically declared their innocence, that they were free of sin. The deceased heart was then weighed against the feather of Mott. The god Anubis was usually shown administering this test, and the results were recorded by the god Thoth. If the heart balanced with the feather, the person was seen as having led a good and proper life, and was therefore worthy to live forever in the paradise of Osiris, god of the afterlife. So it was fascinating to see these kinds of symbolic feathers lining that concourse on Saturday night, that avenue that the mummies would travel along in vehicles adorned with the unfurled wings of Mott. And it was fascinating to see how they had incorporated such symbolism to do with justice and harmony and truth and order into this ceremonial occasion that was organized around the whole idea of giving the remains of these royal ancestors a permanent final resting place, and doing it in a manner suited to their stature and importance in life, in terms of the whole history of Egypt and the legacy left by these royal rulers. A legacy that is awesome, even after thousands of years. And what else did we see there? The glint of gold, to be sure, symbolic of Ra, everywhere. On the logos, on the chariots, on hair and neck ornaments, on jewelry, on the mummy caskets and sarcophaguses, and on the cartouches, the names of the mummies inside the caskets, and of course, the gold of the mat wings embracing those carriers of the mummies. But it wasn't just the sun. There was also that something that to me seemed evocative of the moon. Those basket-like objects carried by the Egyptian maidens, objects that seemed lit from within as if they were carrying small globes of moonlight. Once again, I found this fascinating with regard to the timing, since the Aztec patron of this death-oriented time frame was seen as the conch shell lord known as Tequistecat, who sacrificed himself to become the moon. He is often shown accompanied by Tonatiuh, god of the sun. So, from the perspective of ancient Mesoamerica here, we have the moon and the sun working together to generate new life. And here, in this Egyptian procession, we had what looked like small moons dancing in tandem, so to speak, with the glints of gold that seemed to be everywhere. It was just very, very intriguing and highly inspirational, this dazzling display of art, music, history, and culture. It was like a balm for the soul after more than a year of cultural austerity. No live concerts, no art galleries or museums, no cultural gatherings, on and on. And then suddenly this explosion of music, dance, heritage, artistry, almost overwhelming. And embedded within it all, those symbolic reminders of the core principles of life, as if Mother Egypt was saying, seriously, chaos, mayhem, violence, inequality is not the way to live. Enough of all of that. Let's get back to beauty, harmony, truth, justice, order. All those core principles. Something to think about. Okay, I'd better bring an end to this part, even though there's so much more that could be said. But I should speak a bit about some of the other things going on at this time that also tie in with these general ideas. The pandemic is still out there, of course. And even with vaccination programs underway, the numbers are still incredibly high, and new lockdowns are in place in many countries. The total number of cases in Canada has now surpassed 1 million. India is getting close to 13 million. Brazil passed 13 million. And the U.S. has recorded well over 31 million cases. A few days ago, Brazil broke a new record with over 3,700 deaths on a single day, and India has been recording up to and even over 100,000 new cases a day. Not good at all. To boot, there is massive COVID fatigue out there, like a mental health pandemic that's causing many to thwart even basic preventative guidelines. And there's also a kind of grief pandemic with people having difficulty processing the huge numbers of losses. One healthcare expert the other day saw the COVID situation in the U.S. as being equivalent to a Category 5 hurricane. But people are so fatigued by it all that now they're starting to travel and fill up airports. It's been reported that more than 1 million people a day have been going through American airports for almost a month now. Who knows when it's all going to end or how many are going to die in the meantime. And if that wasn't bad enough, in the midst of a window the other day that would allow people in Taiwan to return home to pay respects to ancestors on Tomb Sweeping Day, which also just happened to coincide with one kimi, one death in the Maya calendar, a busy passenger train carrying 490 people derailed when it collided with a truck that fell onto the tracks. The train had been going through a tunnel and several cars crashed against the walls while others outside overturned. At least 50 people were killed and the last count over 200 were injured. Currently, in the U.S., the focus is on such things as the trial associated with the death of George Floyd. This could have tremendous implications in terms of law enforcement in that country, particularly with regard to racial inequalities and the Black Lives Matter movement. And after another police officer was killed and yet another injured in yet another violent attack in the U.S. Capitol the other day, the issue of security overall in Washington and elsewhere is still a major concern. Americans and their guns, the battle over gun control laws still continues. In this regard, I think it's also interesting to see that the American inventor, Samuel Colt, who invented the revolver in the 19th century, was born on a 5-kimi day that could translate as the targeting of death. But even more specifically with regard to this tresina, a company that was formed to market those weapons that he had just developed, called the Patent Arms Manufacturing Company of Paterson, New Jersey, was chartered by the New Jersey legislature on March 5th, 1836, which was, drum roll please, a 1-kimi, that is, initiation of death, day. And the rest is history. What else is coming up? Two other remembrance-oriented days in the middle of this tresina. One is Five Oak on April the 8th, the blessing of love, also associated with guidance and justice. That will be Holocaust Remembrance Day, Israel's day of commemoration for the approximately 6 million Jews who perished during the Holocaust during the Second World War. At 10 a.m., an air raid siren will signal the start of 2 minutes of silence across that country, so traffic will stop and people will stand at silent attention in remembrance. Then on the 14th, April 14th, there will be another Memorial Day for the fallen soldiers of the wars of Israel and victims of actions of terrorism. On April 9th, Vimy Ridge Day comes in when Canada commemorates the deaths and casualties of members of the Canadian Corps in the Battle of Vimy Ridge during World War I. And if all that isn't enough, we have the reminder at this time of all the events that took place during this same Trisena last July, relating to the death of the heroic civil rights activist and congressman John Lewis, who is seen as the conscience of the United States Congress. John Lewis devoted his life to fighting for social justice. He almost lost his life when he was beaten by white police officers so badly that his skull was fractured on that fateful, bloody Sunday day in 1965, when he was among the leaders of the huge protest march that tried to cross the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, in the call for voting rights for African Americans. But he was never one to give up or give in. He was known for getting into good trouble and was arrested more than 40 times during his activism days. He was first elected to Congress in 1986. Last spring, he had visited that bridge once again to mark the 55th anniversary of that historic civil rights march, and had locked arms with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress as they commemorated that pivotal moment. A little over 4 months later, on the ninth day of this Trisena, John Lewis crossed that bridge for the last time, with his body in a flag-draped casket, traveling on a caisson drawn by two black horses. On that day, the bridge had been covered with rose petals, and family members accompanied the caisson as John made that last crossing. The caisson stopped in the middle of the bridge at the place where John had been beaten all those years ago. John Lewis departed from this world on 13 Chicchan last summer, exactly one 260-day cycle before that extraordinary funerary processional in Egypt. Throughout the Kemi Trisena at that time, there were many special events commemorating his life and achievements. A few months before John Lewis had presided over the Democratic-controlled House as it passed legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act, which had been partially gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. But Republicans refused to take up the bill in the Senate. So on the fifth day of this Trisena last July, 48 senators introduced legislation in the Senate to restore the Voting Rights Act, which by then had been renamed. It's now called the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and it would require any state with a history of voting discrimination within the past 25 years to seek federal approval before making any changes to its voting procedures. It is not yet passed through the Senate, but it is in the works and is badly needed, given the voting restrictions that are being put into place by many states at this time. Throughout this Trisena last summer, there were candlelight vigils in John Lewis's honor. The U.S. House of Representatives held a moment of silence in his honor. A memorial was held for him by the House Democratic Caucus and Congressional Black Caucus. There was the crossing of the bridge ceremony in Atlanta. followed the next day by his lying in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. Then, a few days later, his lying in state at the rotunda of the Georgia State Capitol in Atlanta. His celebration of life and interment took place on the last day of this Dracaena, which was 13 Etznab, which also happened to be his Maya birth energy. All perfectly aligned with the energies of this Kimi Dracaena. Okay. As always, if you would like to contact me to help you to review how these kinds of energies might be working with you personally, in your life, or perhaps in the lives of your bubble or family group, feel free to contact me through the contact information on my Maya Calendar Arts site. To finish out for today, in keeping with the theme, let's conclude with a poem, more specifically called A Harper's Song, from the tomb of Neferhotep, a New Kingdom priest. This is the poem. I have heard those songs that are in the ancient tombs, and what they tell, extolling life on earth and belittling the region of the dead. Wherefore do they thus, concerning the land of eternity, the just and the fair, which has no terrors? For none may tarry in the land of Egypt, none there is who has not passed yonder. The span of earthly things is as a dream, but a fair welcome is given him who has reached the West. It seems that after a very, very long journey, those 22 royal mummies have finally reached the West, as has John Lewis. Hopefully they can all finally rest in peace. As always, be well, keep safe, love to all.